Kierkegaard and Art Making, a Discussion, was led by R. Wesley Hurd on April 26, 2003, at Art Project's Spring Conference on Kierkegaard and Art Making. Art Project is an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
For the last bit of our time together today, I'll frame it in the form of a question that has haunted me and perhaps others in the room here as poets and interested in film and cinema, dance, painting, doesn't matter the art form. If one is taking the struggle for faith, genuine faith, biblical faith, the kind of faith we've been talking about today, seriously, the question arises for me, and perhaps it has for you as well, what constitutes Christian art? Or, another way of putting it, maybe slightly differently, but meaning no different in the end, is art made by Christians always going to reflect that faith? And there are lots of questions that revolve around this that I've talked with people in all kinds of art endeavors who who wrestle with this issue. And I think it would be great to sort of end our time today talking specifically about that issue. I raised the issue of the life view in the last session, and there was actually a method in my madness in that. It occurs to me that if we look at the history of art in particular and of Western Christendom and the history of Western Christian art, that we certainly can look from early Christian work all the way up through, certainly through the Renaissance, and then even into the 18th century, we can find art that art historical books would label as being Christian or religious art. The question that has come to my mind is, well, it certainly wears the label Christian, but at what level does it really reflect authentic Christianity, real belief, the kind of stuff that I think Kierkegaard is helping us think about? It seems to me that this issue of a life view could be a useful tool, a useful concept to use in asking that question. For example, and I'll actually show a slide here in just a minute, show a series of slides, and I want to just simply pose this question as we look at these images and you take them in. Which of them somehow strikes you just in its visual nature, in its formal nature? Which of them strikes you as being closer to something that is obviously driven by a Christian, an authentically Christian life view, and which of them don't? And you can, this is where, when we come to art stuff, there's a lot of fluidity, a lot of opinion, and, you know, a lot of room to move around in terms of one's opinion. Somebody could decide, well, I think this really doesn't reflect authentic faith, and somebody will say, oh yeah, it does. I mean, look at this. I mean, there's going to be that kind of thing going on with art, because it's not often direct. It's very indirect, and sometimes it's so indirect you don't even it takes you a while to even figure it out, and even begin to figure it out. For example, I was talking with someone just a few minutes ago about the work on the walls here. This work here is work done by if you were to just sort of walk around and try to figure out what's going on, you would probably have a difficult time. You could begin to form some ideas about what it might be at, some large general ideas. But then if you go back and read his statement, the artist's statement, all of a sudden the work takes on coherence. All of a sudden you see things that you hadn't been able to see before. A lot of art is like that. At one level, before you understand the artist or the author, before you have a chance to look at a whole body of work, if you just look at one piece, it might take a while. It may be very, very strange and enigmatic to try to figure it out. But if you do your homework, it shows up. It begins to unpack itself for you. So what we're going to do now is look at these slides for a minute. If I could get the lights off in the front here. And when we finish looking at the slides, I'm going to ask Jack to be available to field questions regarding Kierkegaard or other related issues to what he said today, and also I'll try to respond in terms of the art side of things, and also hand the baton to others who have something to say as well. Okay, Andrew? Does everyone recognize who's the artist in this piece?
Michelangelo.
Title? Date? 1500, exactly. It's right around 1500. What's interesting about this piece, this was a piece that Michelangelo did at the very outset of his career. And I have never seen the piece in person. I have seen some remarkably beautiful photographs, accurate photographs of this, and it is absolutely stunning. I have never seen, even in the photographs, you can see that the marble, the way the marble has been treated, is so amazingly flesh-like that you could almost swear. I mean, there's something he's done in this work that is just absolutely almost incomparable to any other kind of work. Of course, he replicated that in his work. But obviously, this is the scene of Mary and the dead body of Jesus in her lap, and of course it's in the Vatican in Rome now, and it's pretty much life size. It was a controversial piece when it was done because it continues to be in some respects because Mary almost appears to be younger than Jesus in this piece. So. But the main point I wanted to mention about this is that this was done at an early stage in his life. Does anyone know the title of this one or what it is? Or who the artist is? It's Michelangelo. It was done, it was actually never finished. He worked on this, was working on it at his death. In some respects, the quality of the piece and the nature of the piece is attributable to the fact that he never finished it. But in other respects, you can see that this is a remarkably different piece than the one he did earlier on. Does anyone know a little bit about the biography of Michelangelo and what happened to him and what he came to later in life? Anyone want to mention that? I'm certainly no expert on Michelangelo, not in the greatest stretch, but I have read enough about him to know that apparently in the last years of his life he was involved in a reform movement within the church, one that was had at some level trying to recover an emphasis on looking at the scriptures more directly and more authoritatively. They also know that there was a recovery of a much more profound understanding and embracing of the faith on a very personal level in his life. I don't think I could honestly say much more about it, but What I see here is, in some respects, I would argue, and I'm proposing, a different life view than what's seen here. Okay? Let's just leave it at that and we'll come back to it. This is a piece called Doubting Thomas. It's about 4 inches wide and about 9 inches tall. It's carved out of ivory. It was done in the 900s, medieval piece of work. There's something about this piece that even the historical art books, the ones that are just the run-of-the-mill university art books, one particular one that I looked at, the author is, in this context of this piece of medieval art, is sort of trundling along, talking about various pieces of art. And then you flip the page and this one shows up. And as you read through the text where he starts to describe or respond to this particular image, the tone of his description changes. He sees something in this piece that changes the way he's even describing or trying to describe or define what this piece is about. And frankly, his wording falls short in the sense of what I think is there in terms of genuine Christian faith, or at least it certainly appears that way to me. But there's something about the portrayal of Jesus, who is in this authoritative position above Thomas, who is lifting his arm in this, literally in this kind of humility, to let Thomas reach into his side. And the way Thomas is grappling, the way he's reaching up to explore the truth, there's just something about this piece for me that is really remarkable in all of art history. There's something going on here, and I think that this work, I would propose that while there's no guarantee of this, that this work definitely embodies someone who was marked by a genuine faith, and that it shows up in the work in a really interesting way. Now we're going to go to the opposite end of the spectrum. Does anybody know who this piece is by? These are sort of obvious pieces. Francis Bacon, done in 1950. It's called, I didn't bring my list of titles with me, I forgot, but this one is, I think it's called Part of a Crucifixion, or a Crucifixion. Francis Bacon was, for those of you that are familiar with Hans Ruckmacher's classic book, Modern Art and the Death of a Culture, on the original printing of that book, and I think it's sitting on the table over there, there's a painting done by Francis Bacon, which is, I think it's entitled something like a preparation for a drawing of Pope Pius the, or Pope John, I can't remember which Pope it is, of the 10th or 9th or 14th or something like that. But it's an absolutely horrifying, what's embodied, what's evoked in the work is this horror of existence, which reflected Francis Bacon's life. If you adjust to the visual language of modern or 20th century art, which for some takes quite a bit of adjusting, but once you acquire an understanding and a taste and actually an interest in the way the visual language of modern contemporary art or 20th century art works, Francis Bacon's work is remarkable painting, but its life vision, its life view is horrific. It is some of the most, I had a professor in art at the university who found out the first 2 or 3 weeks that I was there that I was a Christian. And we had some interesting exchanges that made it clear that he wasn't particularly interested in my faith. But at one point he came in And we were talking about a piece of work that I was working on. He was giving him a critique, and he referred to having seen Francis Bacon's work in Ireland. And he said, I was so, I don't remember his exact words, but he said, I was so horrified and frightened by the work, I almost got religion. So, again, very different life view. Anybody know who this work is by? Dali. Crucifixion. This one? Dali. Exactly. Crucifixion. Dali. The Last Supper. All three of these pieces are extremely, I mean, in certain respects, they're obviously, clearly about Christ, about a Christ figure. They're clearly about religion, about faith, about transcendence, about an otherworldliness. But the question that I'm proposing is this Christian work? Or how would we even talk about it being Christian art? Or would it come under the umbrella of Christian art? Now I want to show you a series of pieces by the French painter Georges Rouault. To Americanize or anglicize it, it's Georges Rouault. Georges Rouault painted his work he started in the late 19th century and worked until, I think he died in the 40s. I'm not absolutely sure about that. He might have even lived into the 50s. I want to just show you a series of his work. He was a French Catholic. He was trained. He apprenticed as a youngster in stained glass for the church. And you can see the work, his work, the effect, the impress, if you will, the impact and similarities in his paintings and his drawings, his prints, with the work he did in lead and glass, colored glass, so stained glass. Crucifixion, the dead Christ, and then the two figures on either side, we'll identify those in a minute. Another crucifixion, again, two contemporary figures, the baptism of Christ. This one is entitled The Judges. It is in secular, legal, civil law judges. Same here, the judges. There are two paintings, two pieces here. Oh my gosh, I wish I could remember the titles. They're so good. So one of them, I think, is the Madam or something like that, and the other one is something like, oh, I know what it is. It's great. The Poser. I love it. Okay, these are all done by Georges Rouault. The Prostitutes, and this last one is called The Old King. Now, what I would propose is that Georges Rouault's work, this is only a sample of his very large body of work. What I would propose is that there is, I think, in his work, in the only 20th century major internationally world-recognized artist whose work, I think, reflects a genuine understanding of faith, a genuine understanding of the human condition. Not only, it's certainly not only because of the religious nature of the work, and the crucifixions, the portraits of Christ. Here one, for example, in this one, the two figures on either side, notice the attitudes. Notice the attitudes that are portrayed in those individuals. Notice the overall, in fact, all of his work as an overall atmosphere or environment or effect or quality has this kind of darkness to it. It's obviously the big, chunky, almost kind of clunky black lines around all of his figures and work. Very, very dark, emotional, scrubbing strokes. They're crude. And the color that he uses, which he does in much of his paintings, many of his paintings, uses color, but it's always counterbalanced, almost overwhelmed by the darkness of the outlines and the atmosphere that he creates in the work. These two figures, he did another whole series. He did a series of lots of paintings of prostitutes, lots of paintings of judges, and lots of paintings of clowns. And what I would argue is I think it's pretty clear that he chose these characters and painted these particular images because they, in his view, reflected the condition of man, the human condition. They were very, very symbolic of how Ruel saw the true human condition. That is, it's poverty, it's tragedy, it's pretense. So it's those kinds of things. When you begin to look at his work, that for me, and I think others, certainly begin to reveal a man of genuine faith. I'm going to scoot on through here. This is a particularly interesting one to me because I just finished doing some study and teaching in the book of Ecclesiastes. In fact, I think I may show this slide in church in the next couple of weeks. This is entitled The Old King. Notice what the king is holding in his hand. Can you tell what it is? It's a little flower. Just this simple one-stem little flower. Could almost be a dandelion, but it's a flower of some sort, very humble, small, delicate. And what's interesting about this piece for me is that it seems to me that at some serious level it captures the biblical picture of Solomon as as a tragic figure in many respects, in a most profound respect, a tragic figure who on the one hand is arrayed in the great robes, the royal robes and gold, rich treasures of jewelry that would have been privy to the king on the one hand, and on the other hand, and the crown, of course, on the other hand, a demeanor that, as I see it, reflects a kind of dignity on the one hand, but a somber, humble, understanding that he is a creature of God, that he is, there's no pomposity in the face of this figure. There's a kind of dignity there, but it's a humbled dignity. And the fact that he holds the flower in his hand, I tend to read that as a statement from Ruel, as a comparison, perhaps even a reference to the statement where Jesus is with his disciples and he says to them, "Behold the lilies of the field." And what does he say after that? "Solomon in all his riches is not arrayed like one of these." And what is the king holding in his hand? A flower. So again, it evokes a vision of a vision of life, a vision of being human, a vision of being under the God who is there. It's very, very powerful stuff as I see it. Okay. We can kind of, if you want to ask questions, I'll use the other microphone. We can pass this one around. What I'd like to ask is this. Let's discuss the whole notion of what constitutes Christian art and how would that show up? Use these perhaps as references to this, and let's mess around with this question of whether or not it might be possible to, in a body of work, try to find, or maybe you wouldn't even be looking, maybe it would just overwhelm you if you were in the presence of this work, experiencing this artwork, that the person's life view somehow comes through, and in ways that are very difficult, maybe perhaps impossible to articulate in words. Commentary, questions, thoughts?
Well, I've had a few things kind of come up recently that seem to speak to this. In that, one of the main comments an actor friend made to me recently was that one of the problems with trying to create what's called Christian theater is that it's, especially in the church, always predisposed to be some sort of foregone conclusion, which basically is the antithesis of theater, which is a conflict. And that in that it was suggesting that theater, and I would probably posit all of art, is about questions rather than answers. And inasmuch as that's true, in my mind, they're works of conflict, or something, some conflict is often involved. It doesn't have to always be that way. I'm sure it could be a celebration of something, but in reference to Kierkegaard, it made me think that perhaps it's the tension between the aesthetic and the, whatever the other one was, ethical, right? And that perhaps that a life view that may be Christian is something that emanates from that, but nonetheless the communication that speaks to the hearts or the resonates with other people is some reflection of either that tension or, well, I would usually say that tension, but maybe there is something about some other image that's a celebration that also resonates. But that's really encouraged me, the idea of questions and art being about a place of questions or that place of tension, because I know that when I usually try to articulate my faith, it's usually something to do with, well, I mean, it's, a lot of it has now become about my questions, because I think that the difference in my experience, like in an art conference like this versus sitting in my church, is that, to quote another book I've been reading recently, that often the church is teaching people what to think rather than how to do it, how to think. And I think that the other thing that I'm observing is that in positing questions through art, then it's either predisposing that the people looking at it or taking it in know how to think, and they're willing to do that, instead of just wanting to be fed something that tells them what to think, or that the piece itself resonates so strongly with our human experience in a universal way that it really doesn't matter, and that everybody's going to get it.
I wonder if that's not the case with in this sense of. By the way, we should just consider this an open thing here. I mean, I've posed a couple of questions, but we can go anywhere we want with this discussion. So, something that Jack alluded to earlier, there was a question that came up that triggered this, and I'm responding to your comment too about the fact that good art it raises questions. Another way I've thought about that is that it also has, good art often has a tension in it. The tension reflects the fact that reality is both, there's something about reality that's really amazing and beautiful. There's something about reality that is profoundly wrong.
Or sacred and profane.
There's a kind of tension there that really touches on the human condition and explores the human condition always seems to raise. That's why we can look at a film that's done by someone who's not a Christian or not a believer, but the fact that they've spoken the truth about the human condition actually can be a profound reminder to us, I think, of the truth of who and what we really are. And that could come in stages. I mean, some art, Jack was talking about strategy, and I've wrestled with this myself. Part of the way I look at what I'm trying to do with my work is build bridges toward a conversation, especially if I'm thinking about the rather hostile secular art world out there. I've had the experience of making pieces that get people to a certain point. There's enough specificity in it in terms of pointing at the human condition that it takes people to a certain point where questions are raised, And in that sense, it seems to me that, I mean, I certainly wanted it to reflect my vision of life. How successfully it did is another question. But at least among certain people, they experienced that as going to a certain place, raising certain questions, pondering what I was trying to say, that kind of thing. Is that what you're talking about, David?
Well, I think so, but I think it's also been recently about what is the latitude that I have, what are the horizons that I have as an artist, and that's why the words sacred and profane come to mind. The other example I've been reading about is a book that just calls itself The Spiritual Journey of U2. It's called Walk On. That it's interesting, it's coming out in Christian bookstores, and what's kind of interesting is that suddenly now Christendom is trying to find a place for these guys because it's becoming more common knowledge anyway that there's a faith that's in their work. And it's just interesting to me that it's even been my own conflict in looking at some of their things, that some of what they've done is so profane in appearance that if you don't look at it in context, you can be, you know, frightened for your brothers in Christ or whatever you want to call it. But in reading certain things in context, to say that there is that much latitude in our experience and in that tension between who we are as, you know, angels and beasts. And I guess that it's really for me about seeking that kind of freedom. I think my whole, it may be a different conversation if you had somebody who didn't grow up in the church, who's now a believer and saying, okay, now how do I express my belief? As opposed to someone who comes from a fundamentalist background and has spent a lot of my initial days in training in art trying to break free from a dogma that says it's irrelevant from the first place, or in the first place. So for me, I guess my statement about Christian art comes from a desire to find how much latitude there really is to express the sacred and the profane and the tension between it. Whereas in a fundamentalist or church context, those boundaries are really narrow.
Someone else? Their comments, questions?
I'll make an As you guys were talking, is this on?
Yeah.
We've been talking somewhat about Christian music, and, you know, not to kick a dead horse, but and then what's interesting is Christian music. I think of Christian music, and then I noticed you didn't have any Thomas Kincaid up here. Mm-hmm. But they're both like really similar in that they both don't deal with that tension. They don't raise that anxiety when you look at it to where you go, what do I think? And it seems like it's in those moments of where you're in that tension and really having to sort out life and the good and the evil is where you have that freedom that Jack talked about to have to decide, what am I going to choose here? But it seems like the Christian music industry as well as the Thomas Kincaid industry, it's like here's this beauty. Don't you see it? It's all great. Everything's wonderful. And don't you? What's your problem? Why are you having such a hard time? So, just it's more of an observation.
Yeah. So. Jack, I wanted to maybe you could take the mic up here, Andrew, to Jack. Could you comment on what you meant by edifying? If you were to take on the issue of Christians wanting to use their work to edify, what do you mean by that?
Well, this is a reflection of Socrates and Kierkegaard, that and I saw the same thing in Socrates in looking at him, that he realized that you need the individual out there, the one that I'm teaching, the one that I'm helping, the one that I'm reaching out to. If they don't grasp it, it doesn't do them any good. So to edify someone is to get them to fall in love with the eternal, fall in love with God, I don't want to use the word fall in love, to learn to love God authentically and genuinely. And anything that I can do that would encourage or promote that in a person is true edification. Jeannie was asking me about this earlier, that there is a kind of false edification that leads us to think, I should use Bible verses, I should be explicit, I shouldn't hide it, I shouldn't be obscure, I shouldn't use indirect communication because I want to edify them, I want to build them up. And so why would I make it hard? I think the reason you'd make it hard is because you want it to be real. And the problem with being too direct is you turn Christians out of people without them becoming believers. But you're not edifying them if you make Christians out of them. You're only edifying them if you're making them believers. And the only one that can make me a believer is me, not you. So I have to be invited to make that choice out of my own volition. That can't be imposed upon me by someone else. And I think that's part of what Kierkegaard is doing with his so-called indirect communication, is that he sees, I can't do for you what needs to be done, but what I can do is try to provoke in you a decision to do what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And that's to truly edify mm-hmm. you.
Mm-hmm. How? Go ahead. Back here. Could we get the mic back to Alex?
I guess all of this discussion makes me wonder if kind of this sort of conscious decision to create something in this way is damaging to the art in the process, and also interpreting it in that way is like projecting too much on the artist. And if maybe it's enough to simply be driven by the, I guess, passion of the authentic gospel, and does that necessarily mean that it has to come through, even in like an indirect way, does it still have to come through the kind of like final product, I guess. I don't know if you...
That's a really interesting question, because I know how I work. I can't talk about how anybody else works, how they write, how they make photography, or whatever they do. When I work, I count on the actual moments of making, the actual where I'm painting or drawing, I'm actually making something. I trust the fact that the sincerity and authenticity of my vision of life is going to come through in a rather intuitive process. And I've talked with lots of artists, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, that would say the same thing. That sometimes the most authentic, real, and best work happens at an intuitional level. For me, and my understanding of what intuition is and how that works, that what that means is that something that's embedded deep within me that is ultimately knowable and rational, that is my belief, comes out and comes through in ways that I can't explain. So it shows up in the work to some degree or another. And maybe it's not even one particular piece. It's more often the case that you have to look at a whole body of this stuff before you kind of get the picture that this person is coming from a certain place, or is even, or something going on with this person that is maybe different than the run-of-the-mill sort of secular, hedonistic, pagan artist. Somebody else like to comment on his question, on this issue of how consciously we...
You're saying you can't not, for you, you can't not do that. You can't not separate.
Well, I sure don't want to speak in some sort of perfectionistic way about myself, but
no.
As I work, that's the way I look at it, because I know after years of wrestling with this stuff that my interest is in making art that at some level, even in its collectivity, even in the body of the work, that my interest is in exploring, understanding, and making statements about the way God sees reality that I'm learning about. And I think that if I put that out in my work in a way that's using the contemporary, in my case, I like to work in a contemporary visual vocabulary, painting, drawing, etc., that the people who understand that language, who understand that vocabulary, are already tuned into the language, so they're looking at how I'm shaping the language, just like what Kierkegaard, what Jack was suggesting Kierkegaard did. He took the current philosophical vocabulary and used that vocabulary to say what he wanted to say. In effect, he ended up subverting contemporary prevalent philosophical thought by using the vocabulary of that thought. And that's kind of the way I think about what I'm doing.
Can I ask a question then along those lines? Just because I think what I'm hearing you say, sometimes it could be taken as though you see your art medium as a medium of didactic sort of teaching,
mm-hmm.
versus something that's, so where there's a tension there, because then you talk about intuition and expressive creativity. I guess the two aren't mutually exclusive.
I don't think art is that. I think it's a different voice by its nature. Jack, did you want to comment on that?
Can I be an entertainer in this life? You know, can I use my art not to be didactic, not to make a point, not to be edifying, but to simply entertain? I should think he would say, sure, but you're doing something different then. But yeah, you can do that. And how would the eternal enter into that? Well, in a different way. I mean, it would manifest itself in different, the people that you're in contact with and how you treat the people that you're in contact with and your attitude toward how much invested in it you are and how much your ego is invested in it. And there's a variety of ways that the eternal would, your commitment to the eternal would show through, but it wouldn't come out didactically in the lyrics of your songs or whatever necessarily. And I should think that he would leave room for that. I don't think he would say that art has to be, art in of itself has to be edifying in order to be legitimate or valid or whatever.
I think that's part of what's refreshing about Kierkegaard and the what he's saying.
Well, in the spirit of Hegel, there's an example. It's a beautiful synthesis of both of these views, and it's the work of Schultz and the Peanuts cartoons. And there is a wonderful book that I recommend to any artist out there interested in the ideas of communicating your faith or what to do with your art, and it's called The Gospel According to Peanuts, or The Parables of Peanuts, and it is a profound little jewel. But basically, the author starts off by saying that he believes that Schultz was using Kierkegaard's idea of a pious deception to get people to think about these things, because we can't draw pictures of Mary and the little lambs and things like that and expect to get people to talk about Christianity. So what we have to do instead is ask them, hey, let's talk about art. And through that medium, then we seduce them into the religious, and all of a sudden they find that they're in the religious, they're thinking about religious, and they're in their religious mode of thought, and they're like, how did I get here? I was reading a comic strip, for heaven's sakes. You know, this is absurd, but there they are. And so that's just an interesting task of the artist, and you know, and they're funny too. So you can instruct and entertain, and that's, I mean, perhaps that's a rare gift that Schultz had, but it certainly is possible.
Somebody else?
I don't know. I just think I want to bring this up. Like, I don't know if there's an actual answer that I haven't really thought of, but Dave and I talk about these things all the time, so I wonder if anybody has any comments. This idea, okay, so he brings up you too, and in their journey in life, they get to be superstars. And then we watch the movie Babette's Feast all the time, where this great singer forgoes her potential, what looks like could be a great career, and serves peasants the rest of her life. And then the other woman artist in the film, who's this great cook, says to her, you know, well, someday you'll delight the angels in eternity. And so sometimes I have to take great comfort in this fact that I don't get to do a lot of what is so affirming for me in this life in creative expression, because I've stopped doing that because I'm being a mom or whatever, or maybe I don't want to offend my family for good or bad reasons, or I give up certain opportunities. And then, so sometimes having an eternal perspective, You think, there's more than this life, so that's not all there is. And of course, that can be a great comfort for everything we think about in this life. So what am I saying? I guess I don't think there is really an answer about... I know that everybody has a different journey, so you can't say, you need to give up your opera career because it's too self-serving, and whereas so-and-so can do it because God is enabling them to learn different things. Oh, blah, blah, blah. Maybe my question would be, do you think that we could be called this, that God would actually ask us to lay down our art? So many of us who come from a background that we've had to fight so hard just to legitimize doing it, that would be the last thing I'd want to give up, because it's finally, I've broken away and becoming my own person. But then that, to have an Abraham experience of having to sacrifice it, that would be really humiliating and hard. But I wonder about that. Do you guys have that question still, even though you come to your own realization that, damn it, I can do this kind of thing? And then it's like, but if it's worth not letting perhaps even my mom and dad understand, maybe there would be a time where it's really not the most important call to make in this. Maybe you've read the book, My Name is Asher Lev, and he, is a Orthodox Jew, and he's wrestling with this question. And sometimes I think it's just not fair that often, and this is totally unfair, I know, but that men have more freedom to go do this because they tend to get to have career define them anyway, whereas women, then we have these added pressures, speaking generally, as to also add parenting as being a primary caregiver, and then our art, and it just gets overwhelming. So that's my essay. Does anybody have
Jack,
anything?
Comment on calling or any of that kind of stuff?
Well, I think I'm convinced that true, I was talking about this earlier with somebody, that true greatness is being able to be a mother, or being able to be a grocer, some kind of doing something humble, that's really true greatness. That greatness in the eyes of the world, that is another phenomenon. But how many of the truly great believers, for example, the great children of God throughout the ages, have made the history books? Not very many. But does it mean that the people that are not Luther and Calvin and Augustine were not great believers? I really don't think so. I think there have been a lot of really obscure, unknown people who have nonetheless have had real greatness of spirit and greatness of soul and have been truly great people. And in the end, that's the only thing that matters. The history books aren't going to be at all important in the end. The acclaim of people, the mass followings, all that kind of stuff is really nothing in the end. So, what am I saying? Yes, some people are called to make it into the history books, and they will, and not to minimize them. Their faith was real, it was authentic, they had integrity in what they did, but they also, by God's design, have made a mark on history, have had a popular response of some kind. But most of the great people in the world with real authentic faith and real character live lives of relative obscurity. And that's just a question of, that's God's call. That's not in our control. We can't even make it happen if we want to make it happen.
Deb?
And it's wonderful, because in Kierkegaard there's a buried theme about this very topic. And W.H. Auden expressed it very well in an essay called Second Thoughts about Kierkegaard. And the idea is that as artists or as thinkers or as, there are a few other things, you're already an exception, because most people aren't those things. Most people aren't really inclined toward the arts. Most people aren't intellectually gifted. Most people maybe aren't even... I don't know any other gifts, but whatever. But the important thing, and it's buried in Kierkegaard, but it's certainly there, is the fact that, Christianly understood, those differences are of no importance. What is essential, Christianly understood, is is the universal human and the experiences that every human being, by virtue of being a human being, can have. So even, and it were, you know, if I was to compare my work with you know, a great poet, Shakespeare or something, and despair over that, it would be foolishness and absurdity on my part, because the difference between Shakespeare and I, eternally understood, is doesn't exist in terms of artists, but only as human beings. So that's kind of an interesting thing that Kierkegaard has. It was a temptation for me, at least, as someone, you know, moderately inclined artistically, moderately endowed intellectually, to then think of myself as somehow able to be a better Christian because of those qualities, able to be a special Christian because of those qualities. And Kierkegaard, I mean, annihilates that thought in a very roundabout way, makes it safe to be an ordinary Christian by exposing the fallacies of this high-cultured Christianity. He says, no, we're talking about the street sweeper, the janitor, and the baker. Those are Christians, not these people who are qualified by their exceptional abilities. So
that might be an extremely appropriate thought to close on. We're about 15 minutes from 4. What I would like to do, if I may, is I'd like to close our time just in a brief prayer, and then twist your arm into taking out that sheet, making a few comments for us. We'd appreciate your feedback, especially on topics, future topics for the art conference, art project. Those kinds of issues would be extremely helpful for us. We appreciate so much your coming, and we hope this has been encouraging and stimulating, and most of all, spiritually encouraging. So we would enjoy hearing any ideas you have about how we can do some more stuff like this. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the day and for last night as well, for this opportunity to be together. I know that there have been thoughts and intentions and motivations revealed to us while we've been sitting here today. Introspection that's sometimes hard to do and hard to know what to do with. We thank you for the work of your your presence with us, because we know that that's a fact. As people who are interested in this thing called art, we ask that you'd give us, just as human beings, give us wisdom and clear vision of what it is that you're calling us to in reference to yourself and understanding the gospel. And then we would pray for your special wisdom in knowing how to do what we love, that is to act, to write, to paint paintings, to do photography, to do the things that you've given us the incredible privilege of doing and being involved in. So we just thank you, and we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.